and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd with me, Barbara Drew. Today, I'm sitting down with Daniel Shaw, founder of Cotswolds Distillery. We'll be discussing English spirits, their history, and most excitingly, their future. Daniel, welcome.
Hello, Barbara. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we get stuck into the exciting world of English whiskey, I'd really love to know a little bit about your background, because you've not always been in the spirits industry. Is that right?
No, I don't come from a spirits background at all, except for being an appreciative consumer. I came from a career of 30 years in finance. During part of that time, I lived in France, in Paris, and I was able to indulge all of my love of good food, good drink, travel, etc. And it's there that I first got into whiskey.
Perhaps with your finance background, you might be aware that, you know, setting up a distillery, making spirit, and then aging it for a really long period of time, years, sometimes decades, it's not necessarily the fastest way to make a fortune, shall we say. So what on earth possessed you to start an English whiskey distillery? Yeah.
People say that very often to make that small fortune, you have to start with a large fortune. And I didn't have a large fortune. I didn't even have a small fortune. I basically put my life savings and the better part of my wife's life savings into this just to follow a dream that I had, because it felt right. It felt like something that after years of a somewhat loveless career, should we say, it felt time to do something that I really loved and was passionate about. But no, financially, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
And why English whiskey? We know about Scotch whiskey. There are, I believe, even some American whiskeys made, but why English whiskey?
You know, I think one of the questions to ask is why nationality? Why with spirits? Why with wines? Do we seem to almost by default always want to categorize them based on the country in which they're made? When, you know, obviously in the world of wine, we have varietals, we have different grapes, we have different regional techniques, soil types, etc. But we love to say French wine or Italian wine, and we certainly love to say Scotch almost interchangeably with whiskey, as we would Kleenex and tissue or Hoovers and vacuums. It is true that is a corner of the world where whiskey is said to first have been made, much disputed between the Irish and the Scotch, but certainly now it's being made around the world, and it's become almost in a way like wine, the expression of a terroir, of a sense of place, of a philosophy, of what one wants to. And, you know, very often it's used, I think, as a way to express the beauty of a place. And I certainly fell under the charms of Scotland and the beauty of Scotland, the beauty of the people and the beauty of the product. But having years later moved to the Cotswolds, or at least weekends, and aspiring to spend more time there because of how beautiful it was, I realized that there was nothing that Scotland had that Cotswolds didn't have. It was every bit as beautiful. It was just a different sort of beauty. It was a more gentle, rounder, sort of a more impressionistic almost beauty, but certainly a beauty that could be expressed through whiskey, given how much barley grows up and down the Cotswolds.
That's such a fascinating point of view, and to my embarrassment after, you know, years of studying wines and particularly on the spirit side, I guess I've never really considered that. You're right, everything is very much categorized according to those regulations, and they really are closely tied to a region, whether it's cognac, which is a very particular brandy that comes from a very particular part of France, or whether, as you say, it's Scotch whiskey. I mean, even in the US, where the regulations are perhaps not quite as tight, you still have your Kentucky bourbons, for example, or your Tennessee whiskeys. So that's a really interesting perspective, that actually the region perhaps doesn't dictate the style quite as much as you would assume just by looking at the label.
Well, I remember I did a talk in seventh grade in public speaking, and it was called Going Against the Grain. So I suppose to some extent, I've always been a little bit disruptive, I suppose, by nature. And the fact that it's always traditionally has been so closely tied to one thing. I mean, frankly, if you look at Japanese whiskey, for example, great success, you know, particularly over the past, let's say, 10 to 15 years, but they've been at it for 150 years, and the world just didn't really catch on to that. But now I think something is really afoot in the world of whiskey, which is world whiskey, new world whiskey, some call it. Although I'd certainly argue that places like Japan aren't quite the new world. And I think it's very similar to what went on with wine 60, 70 years ago, you know, the sort of the famous Judgment of Paris, and the world suddenly discovering a whole new group of wines from Napa, from South America, Australia, and these these were interesting and they were perhaps more geared towards a new generation of drinker. And it wasn't your parents' wine. It wasn't perhaps as wrapped up in its own history. And I think that's kind of where whiskey is going. And that's what's really exciting about English whiskey to me, that it's a subset of this world whiskey group of these strange folks around the world, whether they're in Australia, New Zealand, Scandinavia, making whiskey and taking on the big guys.
Yeah, your point about Japan is an interesting one. Is there a long history that you're aware of making whiskey in England? And it's just that we haven't been shouting about it? Or is this really, truly a new thing that's only started in the past 15 years?
There has been a pretty long history. It's not been done with the intensity that it was done in Scotland. There were a number of distilleries in England. There was the Lee Valley Distillery outside of London. There was a Bristol Distillery. Very often they made whiskies that were sent up to be blended with Scottish malts into blended whiskey. And that was before some of the regulation came into effect that basically prohibited anything from outside of Scotland being used in the making of Scotch. The last one closed down a little over 100 years ago, I think. So the first whiskey made in England since then, I think, dates back to about maybe 20 to 25 years ago or so. We were the fourth, and 45 more followed us. So there's now 49 whiskey distilleries in England. Who knew?
Wow, that is quite a lot. But of course, with whiskey, aging is quite key, or at least with certain types of whiskey. We can perhaps discuss regulations or lack thereof.
I might have a lot to say about that.
So I imagine not all of those 49 whiskies are yet available to taste and enjoy, but maybe quite soon.
Absolutely. I think about half of them maybe are sort of have whiskey at some form, whether it's yet reached the legal minimum of 3 years and a day or on its way. But certainly now there's a good representation of English whiskey distilleries with product actually available and on the market.
Let's take it right back. What is English whiskey? Are there regulations? Does it have to be made in the sort of Scotch model, using perhaps barley or other grains and being aged, as you say, for 3 years and one day? Or can anyone make English whiskey using anything they like?
Let's start with actually what it has to be by law, because still English whiskey would fall under UK and formerly EU law, and the UK law sort of came from there. But basically, to be able to call it whiskey in the UK, whether you're in England or Scotland, it has to be aged for a minimum of 3 years and a day. If you're calling it single malt, it has to be made from barley, from malt barley. And therein, things start to change, because the Scotch Whisky Association has set forth over time a series of rules. For Scotch, for example, it needs to be aged in oak. It needs to be aged in vessels no bigger than 600 liters, I believe. We have the choice in England as to whether to follow some, all, or none of those, while still aging it for 3 years and making it out of barley if we're calling it single malt. But what we're doing now as a group, English whiskey producers have gotten together and formed the English Whiskey Guild, and we are working now with DEFRA to create a GI for English whiskey, which will define English whiskey, English single malt whiskey as well.
So that would be a legally defined region with strict rules. So if you wanted to label your spirit as English whiskey, you would have to follow these rules just as they do in Scotland.
Yeah, there's a verification scheme. You can opt into it if it's approved. In order to call your whiskey English whiskey, you'll need to comply with those. We've spent a lot of time debating what those rules ought to be. And on the one hand, encouraging consumer confidence in the category in terms of the quality and the premium nature of it, but not so far as to stifle creativity, because we don't want to just be copycats of Scotch whiskey. We want to determine our own future.
That's fascinating. You used the word copycats there. So is this going to be a sort of deliberate movement away from the Scottish style, trying to differentiate English whiskey rather than simply following their tried and tested methods and regulations?
Well, you know, once again, this idea of this pan-national identity of a whiskey comes into question. And even with wine, could you tell me what French wine tastes like? That's the thing. I don't think that there's one style of Scotch whiskey. I think that there are a lot of distilleries that are following certain regulations, but still trying to express themselves, whether it's their technique, their process, their terroir, if you buy into that. And I did enough to want to build a distillery in the Cotswolds, but I think differences really have to be celebrated. So, I mean, for example, I would argue that there is a new breed of whiskey distillery now opening up in Scotland. There's a number of them that have, that might very well identify more with us because we're fellow small guys, we're challengers, than they would with their brethren who are sort of Diageo owned or Pernod Ricard owned. To be a small distiller is a very unique and very often pretty painful thing, just in terms of the capital, time, and wanting to be different.
A point on the oak that you mentioned. So in Scotland, you have to age your whiskey for a minimum of 3 years, and it does need to be in relatively small barrels, as you said, 600 litres or smaller. Are you or are any other English whiskey distilleries that you know of experimenting with different formats of oak, or indeed not aging in oak at all, aging in something else for their 3 years?
I do know of a few distilleries that on a small size have experimented with other types of wood. There's chestnut, there's cherry, there's acacia that have been known to impart nice flavor to whiskey. We haven't gone there really. We find ourselves not because of the idea of copying, but just simply best practice and things that sort of make a good product. Staying with oak, of course, there's subsets of oak. There's European oak, there's American oak, and we try and play with those because they season, in effect, the whiskey differently. We use different sizes of casks, although they're all pretty large. Our colleagues in the States, where there is no 3-year minimum aging requirement, tend to go very small in their use of casks because they're putting out whiskey that's sometimes 12 months old, 6 months old, even 3 months old. So we can't do that, and nor would I think we want to. So there's a lot of similarities, and we're not looking to be different for the sake of being different. We'd only be looking to be different if we felt that it gave us a flavor profile that we liked or wanted to express in some way.
Now, you mentioned earlier the terroir, the very specific environment that you're in the Cotswolds, and you try and express that in your whiskey. I know that the flavour profile of the Cotswold whiskey is perhaps a little different to other whiskies that you might encounter. So can you tell us just a little bit about how you go about achieving that?
I was very much inspired in the setting up of this distillery by a distillery that I know and love and actually own a cask of their whiskey, which is also what got me down this sort of wormhole, which is Brooklady on Islay. And Brooklady was bought by someone who was very, Mark Renier, who was very focused on terroir and who now has Waterford Distillery in Ireland and is really taking the terroir thing to its extreme with lots of different farmers planting in lots of different grounds and different types of barley. We haven't gone that far. And I would personally feel, especially with what I've learned, that with all the things that go into making whiskey, you know, you're boiling it up multiple times, you're distilling it multiple times, you're aging it in different types of wood. And wood, of course, is what really gives a lot of flavor to the whiskey. I cannot hand on heart say that I feel that the type of barley that we're using, the variety, is really going to come shining through. So people say, well, why is it important that you buy all your barley in the Cotswolds? And I very often just sort of responded with the truth, which is that it feels right. It feels good. I mean, it feels crazy to have barley farmers all around us and not be getting our barley locally. It feels great to know our farmers. Michael and Philip Green, super nice father and son. I actually knew the third generation. He passed away, but 5 generations of tenant farming on the Blenheim estate in Coombe, which is about 15 minutes away from us. So it's really nice to know where it comes from. It's really nice to know in an age when everybody is trying to be as carbon neutral as possible and as sustainable as possible to know that our barley has less than 200 road miles on it. It gets taken out of the ground in Coombe. It gets dried and sent down to Warminster, which is just outside of Bath in Wiltshire, to Britain's oldest working maltings, where it's malted by hand, which is really cool if you're a whiskey geek like me.
The malting process, that's where barley grains, they're sort of encouraged to sprout. They're tricked into thinking it's spring.
Exactly.
They start sprouting, and that helps to release the enzymes that you're then going to need to turn the starch in those grains into sugar ready for fermenting.
Absolutely. And that used to be done locally in every village had a maltings, and it would is basically done on long floors, and you would turn the barley to sort of keep the air coming and concentrate the heat when you needed it a little bit warmer to encourage the germination. Nowadays, it's done in things that look like enormous sort of cement trucks, that drums that slowly turn and can do hundreds of tons at a time. Warminster, which is very, very old, 100 years old, still has malting floors, and it's still done by hand. From Warminster, that barley comes up to us. We take all the good stuff, the sugar out of it, and then it goes to Rob, our dairy farmer across the road, to his cows. One of the things they kind of don't tell you up north about their whiskey code, it's got to be made, matured, and bottled in Scotland, but the barley can come from pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
And very often does. What terroir means, the other part of it is, as the first people to make whiskey in the Cotswolds, is what should Cotswolds whiskey taste like? We get to choose. That's pretty wonderful. And, you know, when you think about what grows in the Cotswolds, which is basically grain, fruit, a lot of flowers, and it seemed that a floral and fruity style made sense for our whiskey. And we had an amazing Scottish mentor by the name of Jim Swan, who understood how to make a wonderful fruity and floral whiskey. And that's what he taught us how to do.
Beautiful. You've really tempted me, and I can just see just over your shoulder, there's a bottle of whiskey there calling to me, which we will open very shortly. But before we do that, I wanted to touch a little bit on the end of the whiskey making process, which is something that I think isn't discussed as much. There are quite a lot of byproducts. There's quite a lot of waste products. How do you deal with all of that? You've mentioned the spent grain, but the things that come off the still that you're not putting into bottle, what happens to all of those?
The effluent stream that's created by making whiskey is a very natural thing, because basically there's only three ingredients in whiskey: water, barley, and yeast. But when you boil it all up and you concentrate it and you take out certain elements and leave others in, it's too strong a liquid to just go to drain, to go out into the water course. So what we've always done, which was relatively green, I suppose, is basically take that to a series of different anaerobic digesters out in the countryside that farmers typically have to turn waste into biogas. So that's good, except that you have to get it there somehow. And typically that involves a lot of big 30,000 liter tankers rolling through a very cute little village, which is our local village. So when we were offered a few acres of land contiguous to the distillery, we had the idea of using the land to help treat, to help purify that effluent. And we spoke to a couple of scientists up in Scotland who had created systems, what they call wetlands, ecological treatment systems for some of the big distilleries up there, Glenfiddich. They also work for Glengoyne. And we thought that was a terrific idea. And their premise was pretty simple, which is that in nature, one organism's waste is another organism's food. And so there's a way of managing nearly anything. And their talent was finding the right mix of plants to be able to handle various streams of effluent. And not just whiskey making effluent. They work in BP refineries and chemical plants and green them up in such a way that plants can naturally break down some of these effluent streams. So we went about planting several acres of wetlands cells and then planting about 14,000 plants and 2,000 willow trees, which when it's all up and running and working, which should be this spring when everything starts to kind of come into bloom, will naturally process 100,000 liters a week of effluent. And that's not just a good effort. That's 3.5 lorries that I don't need to order every week. So it's the idea is to sort of become a bit of a lighthouse site in the Midlands, in our part of the world, for alternative ways to manage effluent streams and have people be able to come in. And seeing as we get about 100,000 people a year to the distillery, we can actually show this off as part of our tour so people get an idea of how you can manage things.
Yeah, I think that sometimes with spirits, as with wine, there can be this misconception. Well, you don't have that many ingredients. You've got barley and there's yeast and water, so it's a perfectly natural product. And the same with wine. Well, you know, it's grapes. I mean, you don't need much else. But actually, there are definitely ways that you can make these processes exceptionally green and sustainable. And there are also ways of making these products where there might be some byproducts and perhaps it's not as optimized for the environment as it could be. Really interesting to hear about that.
I certainly didn't know. No one told me on all the tours that I did that I was going to have to deal with this as a whiskey maker and have these enormous tanks. But nowadays, actually, people are more interested in all aspects of the process. They don't just want to hear the standard sort of patter and the little tasting wheel or whatever. They really want to get to the bottom of it.
I like those tasting wheels. I think they're really helpful in describing what you're smelling and tasting.
They do. And as a matter of fact, I think that one area that whiskey has always led in is in really strange, offbeat tasting notes.
Oh, good grief.
Scotch Malt Whiskey Society really pioneered that and for people to have fun with that. And that's, again, that's what drew me into whiskey, was just the range of different flavors you could come up with mixing grain and wood and alcohol.
Well, I think it's definitely time to taste some of this wonderful liquid.
It was a great honor for us to be asked by Barry Brothers to provide a cask of our whiskey to do a Barry's Own English whiskey bottling as one of a couple of English whiskeys that Barry's bottled in 2023. For me, it was really full circle because as a whiskey geek in training, sort of back in 2001, after a trip up to Scotland, my best friend and I came down to London. I'd never been in Barry Brothers before. And we arrived in at what was then still the shop at number 3, St. James, and met Doug McIver. And it was fascinating. Every time you come into this place, really, you feel the history vibrating around you.
Yeah.
And I walked out with several bottles of Barry Brothers whiskey, several of which I still have in my whiskey collection. And to think now that we are one of them, it's part of this whole full circle thing, going from an appreciative consumer to a maker, which is incredible. But we wanted to try and come up with something special. So we bottled one of our most expensive casks. And when I say expensive cask, it's literally the barrel itself that is so expensive, because it's a newly made Spanish oak hogshead, so a 250-liter barrel, which was seasoned with Oloroso sherry. And when I say newly made, I mean the wonderful gentleman that we work with in Spain, Miguel Martin, who's well known for providing sherry cask to the whiskey industry, has a complete vertical production from the sawmills he owns, both in Galicia and in Pennsylvania, for his American and Spanish oak,
wow,
to the cooperage, to the winemaking, to the seasoning warehouses, and even to the vinegar factory, which is where the sherry finally goes after its third or fourth use in seasoning casks. So they cost an awful lot of money, multiples of the sort of the bourbon casks and the red wine casks that we use, but they just impart such amazing flavors. That's why we decided to go with that one for this very special bottling.
So this is a single cask bottling. So our listeners who are spirits nerds and particularly whiskey fans may well be aware. So a single malt whiskey is one that's made from 100% malted barley, and it's the product of just one distillery. But this is also a single cask. It's cask number 2194, and it's also unchill filtered and natural colour. Is it true that English whiskey can't be colour adjusted? You can't use caramel to change the colour, or have you just chosen to
Everything we do is non-chill filtered, because chill filtration, which is meant to give you a more clear spirit, also takes out lots of flavor, and we work so hard at putting that flavor in. It seems crazy to take it out. And natural color, because there's a bit of a myth that the darker the whiskey, the better the whiskey. And there's some wonderful whiskey that is pale, golden, straw colored. So we just go with whatever the cask gives us. But being a sherry cask, this has got a very nice, deep golden hue.
It's beautiful. Yeah, really, really rich color. Before I'm tempted to dive straight in here, I notice it's also bottled at pretty much cask strength. So 53.5%. So perhaps a little stronger than you might find in some bottles. What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, actually, that strength is not full cask strength, because we cask at 63.5 degrees of alcohol. And typically in our relatively cool climate, there is more alcohol that evaporates with the angel's share than water. So the strength actually goes down, whereas in warmer climates, you sometimes get the strength going up. But so it's usually about sort of 60, 61 degrees when we disgorge a cask. Why have we brought it down to this level? Well, this is what we would call, rather than cask strength, we call it distiller strength. It's the way we like to drink it. We've all probably gotten a bit too used to drinking slightly higher strength alcohol. You know, I would just point out, this is not about alcohol. I always say that I think of myself more as, you know, sort of a perfumer would. You use alcohol as a way of transmitting a scent, and we use it as a way of transmitting scent and flavor. So it's not about that strength of alcohol, and certainly there's nothing wrong with adding water, however much water you want. But what we do here with a higher strength is we give the drinker the chance to add the water that he or she likes rather than do it for them.
I mean, the first thing that I noticed by this is there's a remarkable, almost like a lightness. I mean, there's a huge amount of aroma, but in no way do you notice the alcohol when you smell this. There's no sense of harshness. There is that sort of floral and orchard fruits, a little bit of citrus, a bit of lavender there. But it really feels, it's done with quite a delicate touch. It's charming.
Thank you so much.
Dive straight in and have a taste. So something that I talk about a lot when I'm tasting is texture, both for wines and for spirits. Yes, this has got the richness that you would expect from a single malt. There's sort of a little bit of oiliness to it, but the overall texture, it's silky and it's seamless. Again, absolutely no rough edges. The alcohol it's barely perceptible, to be honest. Really sinuous texture there. Absolutely beautiful. And then on the finish, just those lovely, again, floral, subtle fruity notes. You were mentioning interesting descriptors for Scotch whiskey earlier, and certainly none of those spring to mind. It is that lovely fresh in the floral side rather than the sticking plaster or horse saddle or anything like that.
What I find, aside from the fact that I still have a tough time, well, I mean, most of our whiskey tasting is done at 10 in the morning. And that just means that the first one or two whiskeys you taste are a bit of a write-off because your palate is just in such shock to be drinking something like this that early. But then once you warm up a bit and your palate gets used to it, you get a lot more out of it. But one thing you'll get out of this on top of, as you said, the sort of fruity and floral whiskey is a little bit more wood spice than you might normally do. And that's because of the use of Spanish oak. Spanish oak is very different from, or all European oak, from American oak in that it's got bigger pores. It allows more tannin to come out into the spirit. And there's also a sort of a vinous quality, for lack of a better expression. Some of the sensations you get if you were walking through a sherry bodega, wonderful sherry cellar, those musty, winey sort of smells, which marry really well with a nice fruity floral single malt.
Yeah, there's this beautiful, slightly nutty, slightly raisiny character, but it's so well integrated. It doesn't sit apart from the whiskey. It's, yeah, they work hand in hand. It's really, really, really beautiful, dangerously delicious at this time of the day, to be perfectly honest. I think sometimes there can be a misconception that whiskies are heavy, they're fierce, they're harsh, and that they're not for everyone. But I think just as there's a Chardonnay out there for every type of wine drinker, there is a whiskey out there for anyone who wants to try spirits. And I think this is a really, really, really beautiful and approachable style, but still with that wonderful complexity. A real treat to open that up. Thank and of course, you. The great thing with spirits is having opened the bottle, you don't have to finish it all in one go. They will keep quite happily. Once they're bottled, they're pretty much preserved as they are. They're really not going to change very much. And even when the bottle is open, they will keep really happily for a year or 2 years and without any change in character.
I hope so, because I still have about 2 inches at the bottom of the Berry Brothers bottles I bought 20 years ago. And I was wondering how oxidized will they be, but pleasure will be in finding out. So one of these days.
Exactly. So this is where we are currently with English whiskey. What does the future hold for English whiskey or English spirits in general? Because of course, we've seen a huge amount of English gin being made over the past couple of decades. Do you think that gin will start to fall and whiskey will rise, or is everything just going to boom?
I think the rise in popularity, and completely unexpected, by the way, and we make a fantastic gin, which is probably half of our sales. And it was completely unexpected. People say, oh, you must have planned this all out. How clever that you sort of started with gin while your whiskey was aging, and that's how you got your cash flow. And I always say that's giving me a lot more credit than I deserve. I simply just wanted something on my shelves in case the odd visitor turned up during the 3 years we were waiting on whiskey. And we ended up making quite a fantastic gin called Sol's Dry Gin. But it took off because it was a good gin, but also because there was this huge surge in interest in the gin category. And the people who were interested in the category were flavor explorers, as we sometimes describe them. They were people who cared about what they were smelling, what they were tasting in a way that lots of folks just never did. And once you go down that rabbit hole, you tend to continue. You tend to start to look for other flavors, maybe more bold or more interesting flavors. So a lot of times that leads people to whiskey, because with whiskey, there's another dimension, which is the dimension of wood and time. So I think that the interest in alternative whiskeys that are less well known, is going to continue. And that's not just in the UK. That's going to be all around the world. And particularly we're seeing, let's say, in India right now. I mean, India's the world's biggest whiskey drinking nation, but lots of what is allowed to be called whiskey in England isn't quite whiskey as we know it. But as people's incomes rise, so does the desire to try to move up the ladder. And hopefully English whiskey as part of world whiskeys will be a fast growing area. And interestingly, it's an area that I don't think the Scots begrudge us a bit of trade in, this because frankly, we help to bring people into the category. And what's good for the category is good for Scotch as well.
I would agree. Yes, I think in the drinks industry, both for wines and for spirits, they are small enough industries in their way that anyone who is making good quality product is a benefit for the industry at large. Of course, there's friendly competition always, but I can't see that even if there were another 50 English distilleries, that would be a problem if they're all making liquid that's as fantastic as this.
Well, and I would emphasize the word friendly. It is a really friendly industry. And coming from the city, from finance, I can say that maybe the money isn't quite the same here as it is there. I mean, the city, it's just not a lot of fun, let's be honest. I mean, compared to the spirits business, the wine business, these are genuinely lovely industries, very much focused on relations, on traditions, on occasions. teams, and even people who compete against one another can work together, can help one another, can be supportive of one another. And that's just great.
So speaking of occasions, are there particular occasions when you like to pour a whiskey? Do you serve your whiskey with food? Do you have it on its own? Do you have it as an aperitif with a splash of water before a meal?
I have to use the words of the late, great Michael Jackson, not the gloved one, the other whiskey writer. He used to use a term called the contemplative dram. It's that
beautiful
sort of end of day. You know, if you've had a hard day, maybe you just want a little treat. It might not necessarily be in a big social occasion. I sort of live in the middle of nowhere. I live in a field where there's not lots of folks around. And maybe you're just with your partner, with your wife, and my case, and you pour yourself something that's really a very small little bit, and every bit as enjoyable just nosing as drinking. So it's that sort of little ritual that, to me, it might involve heading up to bed early and a good movie on Netflix. It's not particularly glamorous or social, but that's definitely probably my favorite time.
I think sometimes a lack of glamour is underrated. Yes, there are show-stopping occasions where you might pour a drink, but actually it's all of those other occasions where it just adds that little extra indulgence or that little extra treat where it's really important.
In our marketing now, we're very much focused on an occasion which we're calling the signature moment. And that's probably because our flagship whiskey is called Signature. But it's featured in some of our recent communication. And it's a visual, which is sort of a group around a fire pit in the Cotswolds. And it was designed really to reflect what I think is the difference between maybe New World whiskey and Old World whiskey. The people in the shot are young. They're not old. It's men and women. It's not just a man's drink anymore. There's a lot of women that are getting into whiskey. It's not indoors, as many whiskey ads sort of are shot in the leather chair in front of the fireplace.
By the fireplace.
Yeah. It's outdoors and it's a fire pit rather than a fireplace, because fire pits are more communal and inclusive. Yeah. And it's the kind of memories, perhaps, that you might have had on a great weekend in the Cotswolds that the Cotswolds does really well. And it's that kind of moment in your life that I think, even if you'd never heard of the Cotswolds and you live in Japan, you might have had a great picnic under the cherry blossoms or something. But it's the times in your life that you want to remember, you know, great moments and hopefully, you know, great flavor out of whatever it is that you might be drinking.
It's come to my attention over the course of our conversation that you might not, in fact, be a native of the Cotswolds. Are there other sorts of spirits that you enjoy drinking? Do you ever delve into the spirits of the US?
I've been here nearly 20 years. I've got the passport, the British wife. I cannot get rid of the accent. I do as hard as I try. There are spirits from all over the world that I love. I got into whiskey through single malt, and I was never really a bourbon guy, but I then started to get in touch with my bourbon side. I think it was initially in Louisville, Kentucky, over an amazing dinner, which included sort of fried pickles and chicken and waffles and sort of and some amazing bourbons with a Scot, actually, I was with at the time. But during COVID, like many other folks who had time on their hands and Amazon able to deliver lots of things, I ended up trying lots and lots of bourbons. And there's more variety, sort of more difference than I originally gave them credit for, depending on the grain bill and, you know, the process. And there's a few that I have absolutely love.
One final question before we head off. Setting aside Cotswolds whiskey, which one whiskey would be your desert island drink?
That's a tough one, but I typically go with two or three whiskey makers who I know, who I appreciate. I really love their style. And as it happens, they're not in Scotland. They're also fellow, you know, usurpers. One of them in particular is a whiskey that I love that's made by a distiller in the Netherlands, Patrick Zwiedem. The name of the whiskey is Millstone, and it's a Dutch distilling family, and it's gone from father to son, and Patrick grew up around whiskey, and I really appreciate the flavors, the way in which he makes it, and the values, and the fact that, again, he's another outsider like me, making great whiskey in an unexpected place.
And thank you so, so much for your time. This has been such a fascinating conversation, and I am going to go and review my spirits cupboard, because I think it is a little short on whiskies from around the world, as you say.
Maybe missing an English whiskey or two.
Indeed, at least one.
Great fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to browse the producers mentioned in today's podcast, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or if you're interested in starting your own spirits collection with Berry Brothers and Rudd, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Cheers.